So what was this podcast about again?
Oh, comic books. We're totally talking about comic books this week. Space comic books. There's a new Wing Commander comic book coming out. No, there isn't. I just made that up. But that would be awesome if there was a Wing Commander comic book. Maybe there'll be a Star Citizen one if it does well enough. But yeah, we talk about space games on this podcast. And Paul, my friend, my good friend, you have it rough because you have been something of an advocate, really. I wouldn't go so far as to say pusher or dealer. I would say advocate.
A paid shill. You have been a paid corporate shill.
No. An advocate for a game that hasn't gotten a lot of love. And I'm guilty of this as well. This game is Sword of the Stars 2, The Lords of Winter. And I will admit, I didn't play it when it first came out because I didn't have a computer that could run it. But when I finally got around to playing it, I was very kind of put off and confused.
So Brian, you didn't play the game when it first came out because it was pretty broken when it came out. I mean, that's even if you had the computer that was able to do that. I mean, Sword of the Stars 2 has had a rocky history, and the developers behind it, Kerberos Productions, they've got an interesting history as well. Let me preface this like I do with all of my other Sword of the Stars discussions. I'm not an employee of Kerberos. I know the guys and gals who work for Kerberos because of their long history, right? So, and we can talk about that. A lot of things that you guys have talked on previous podcasts, there are actually team members within Kerberos that have participated in those sorts of things. So the CEO of Kerberos and the lead writer, so Martin Cerulis and Aaron Dembo, respectively the CEO and creative director and the lead writer for Kerberos, they used to write manuals and backstory for computer games under the pseudonym of Crabapple. So they actually wrote the Homeworld manual.
Oh,
very cool.
And then the
That was a really nice manual, if I'm recalling.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the team itself, originally its first iteration was called Barking Dog, and those were the folks that did
Homeworld
Cataclysm. Yep.
Which apparently is the best version of Homeworld, which I still have not played.
I like Homeworld a lot. I thought Homeworld was an excellent space strategy game, and they did some new stuff, you know, that hasn't really been repeated since. Yeah. Homeworld Cataclysm was cool because it went in a bunch of interesting directions. For me, Homeworld 2 is not a favorite of mine. I mean, the technology update was nice and everything, and the UI update was nice and everything, but the level design was 100% puzzle-based. So
that's what I've heard. Yeah, you're not the first person to tell me that.
Yeah.
So was that puzzle-based in, like, these events are going to happen and I have to have foreknowledge of it so that I decide to put my things in the right places?
Right. So one of the cool things about Homeworld was that you built a fleet, and then at the end of the level, you jumped the fleet into the next level, right?
Yeah.
So you would go into a level in Homeworld 2, and you would need a particular type of ship. A technology would unlock, or you'd run into some aliens, and you would develop this technology to give you corvettes or something like that. And in order to win the mission, you needed to build a shit ton of corvettes. So you build all your corvettes, and you jump to the next mission, and corvettes are useless in the next mission. It's all about the frigates. So your entire fleet that you just built is useless in the next mission. Oh, you have to scrap it all. They'll get destroyed. You got to scramble. It was just way too frustrating around that. But
wow, I think you've put me directly off of Homeworld.
Yeah, I mean, I am eventually going to play it because of, you know, the list. But yeah, I'm not looking forward to it now. I mean, I kind of wasn't to begin with, but now I'm really not looking forward to it.
But. Right, skirmish mode, right? That's still decent, right? So the single-player campaign, that's my big issue with that. But Homeworld Cataclysm didn't have that issue. It was interesting. It went in different direction. It's got space zombies in it. I mean, that's really the main bad guy of the game is space zombies, which is kind of fun. So anyway, those guys who did Barking Dog, then they followed up with Treasure Planet Battle at Procyon.
Oh my God, no they didn't. That is a great...
Yes, they did.
Exactly. Oh, wow. Wow, yeah, I haven't played a lot of that, but I've toyed with it now that I've just seen the movie recently for the first time.
I was going to say, I wasn't aware that there was ever a game. Yeah, well,
there were actually a couple Treasure Planet games, but this is the good one.
Yes, exactly. It's Starfleet battles with Age of Sail type ships in outer space.
Surprisingly robust for what's meant to pretty much be a kid's game. It's actually fairly layered and detailed.
So that's where I first started talking to those guys, because when Treasure Planet Battle of Procyon came out, for some reason the local Walmart in my town at the time broke the street date. So I picked it up early, took it home, played it before even the movie was out, and I wrote it up for this dinky little website that my guild clan was running.
You totally spoiled yourself for the movie by playing the game.
The game had so little to do with the movie. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, it takes place well after the movie, apparently. Yeah,
well, and there isn't even a battle at Procyon in the game, so which is kind of fun. But anyway, so I wrote it up and I said, hey, you know, yes, it's a movie tie-in and all that kind of stuff, but this game ain't bad. So that actually got me on the radar with those guys. And so they actually then, they're up in Vancouver, so they ran into some financial troubles after Battle of Procyon. There's all sorts of, I mean, you guys know, being insiders or understanding the industry, you know how tough it is to keep a studio running. So they actually became Rockstar North and started working on Bully. And recognized after a couple of months of working on Bully that they really liked space games and didn't particularly like the idea of doing prep school simulators. So they decided to strike out on their own. And so the designers and producers and some of the engineers split off and said, well, this is the type of game that we want to make. And they became Kerberos Productions. And then one of the chief engineers, one of the head engineers, Blair Fraser, said, I want to go in a different direction. And he grabbed his brother and they started Ironclad. So that's where Sins of a Solar Empire, and the Kerberos guys made the original Sword of the Stars.
And didn't they come out around the same time?
Yeah, roughly the same time. Yep. That's funny. So one of the things that the Kerberos guys do is if you go to their website and their forums that they have, is that they talk directly with their users on a regular basis, right? So you've got developers, and Martin himself, he's got a reputation because he's definitely a no-holds-barred kind of guy and treats the forum as his living room and things like that. Anyway, so they started putting out all of this information about the game ahead of time because they weren't filtered through PR, they weren't filtered through the publisher. They wanted to get people excited about the game. So I took my site that I had and was messing around with the technology at the time and set up a wiki that took all of their FAQ stuff and put it into the wiki instead of having the wiki on the forums or things like that. The cool thing about the wiki is that it wasn't just me, right? If you've got one person who controls the FAQ, then they've got to keep it up to date. This way, I just open it up to the entire community. Everybody dumped a bunch of information in there, and it really helped with the game moving forward. So that was 6-7 years ago. That I did all that, and so I run the wiki for the Sword of the Stars 2 as well, but I really don't participate much in it nowadays. I just really kind of run the website and make sure that the lights are still on from that. But by setting all that wiki stuff up and things like that, you know, I said, hey, you may not know who I am, and they're like, no, we remember from when you called Battle at Procyon not a bad game, and said, you know, is it okay if I make this official unofficial wiki for you guys? And they said, yeah, absolutely. And that was kind of the start of our friendship. So I don't work for them. I'm not part of their PR. They've never paid me a dime in my life, so I'm just a fan of their work and the stuff that they do. So
it's a very detailed way to say that, but that's great. That's great info. I did not know that there was such a lineage behind them.
The stuff when you guys talked about music, so Paul Ruske, he runs Studio X Labs. Yes, he has done all the music for all the Sword of the Stars games.
No wonder the music in Sword of the Stars 2 is so good.
Yep.
Yeah, sometimes I was just going to sit there and listen to the menu because it's a great, great bit of music.
They actually released the OST, so on Steam. You can grab it on there. Yep.
I'll probably have to do that, won't I? But wow, I had no idea. Like I said, there was such a lineage behind them. Now, I'm going to be honest; I never really played the first Sword of the Stars. I was going through a break from gaming at that point in my life, and I missed the first Sword of the Stars and the first Sins of a Solar Empire.
That's okay. I played it enough for both of us, so I haven't played the second one like hardly at all. I've loaded it up and kind of gazed through it a little bit, but I haven't actually. I wouldn't say I'm like 10 turns into a game yet because I haven't found my footing for a point of entry to it yet. So maybe I've just been away from it for so long, but it's just like trying to like comprehend the interface again. Has it changed a lot since the first game?
Yeah.
Or am I just old
now? No, it actually has. Sword of the Stars 2 is a very different game from Sword of the Stars 1. Two reasons for that. One of the things that I really, really like about the Sword of the Stars universe is the amount of lore that they've put into the universe.
Right. Wasn't there at least one novel?
Yeah, there's one novel that's out which actually covers the time frame between the original Sword of the Stars and the first expansion. So Sword of the Stars came out, and there were two expansions and then kind of a little expansion pack at the end, kind of a half expansion at the end. And then Sword of the Stars 2 came out, and the first expansion came out a couple months ago. There's still plans for a second expansion. And things happen in a linear timeline for the universe of Sword of the Stars. So Sword of the Stars 1 is the original 13 years after humanity first figures out FTL. That's where you start with Sword of the Stars 1. And then you get the expansion, which is which you find a new race, right? So there's four original races. You find a new race, and there's a whole backstory behind them and lore behind them. Then time passes, and you get another new race in the second expansion, and then a big cataclysm kind of thing happens, or at least tides of cataclysm happens. There's this whole shift of Sword of the Stars 1 is kind of set up in a World War One, you know, fledgling empire kind of ideas, and then Sword of the Stars 2 is more around, all right, things are more established. This is a little bit more like World War II. And the big bad guys of the whole universe actually show up in Sword of the Stars 2. So there's this through line and story that they're telling, although there's no campaign in any of these games. There's just advancements and foreshadowing that occurs.
So how does the lore present itself? Is that like color items that are in technologies that you research and you just have to glean the story out of events that develop?
It's technology items, it's random encounters. So in the very first Sword of the Stars, you would play and there would be a random encounter where slavers would show up at your colony. And these nasty-looking junky ships would show up and they'd drop these big saucers and they'd go down to your planet and steal a bunch of colonists and go running off. Those guys were actually the Zool, the first expansion race that showed up later on. There were big pieces of armor that were floating in space, like alien derelicts that have been ever since the very first Sword of the Stars game has been in the game. Those things actually turned out to be pieces of armor of these huge, what they call the Sulka, the big bad guys of Sword of the Stars 2. So they've got this world and this universe that they've created in their heads and this timeline that they're moving across that they're not explicitly telling in story, but they're kind of showing through the game, and it really kind of gives a lot of underpinnings to the game to make it. Realism is the wrong word, but it's there's depth to it that's
flavor to it. There's flavor to it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about the races. So the humans are human. So there's not a whole lot to say about them, right? Other than their drive technology is kind of different.
Right, so that's the big thing about sort of the Stars 1 and 2 is that every different race has a different FTL technology. So the humans are jump drives. So they've actually, their ships have these big rings on the back of them that they use for their jump drives. So they can go very fast from one star system to another star system, but they're limited to particular lines that they can go down. They can slowboat to anywhere, but they move at sublight speeds to do that. So if you run into a system that actually doesn't have any jump lines, you can still get there. It's just going to take you a long time.
So who else was in there? There was the... Was it the Lear? They're basically space dolphins.
Right. So right? The Lear are the space cetaceans. They are telekinetic, telepathic space dolphins. And their story... So let me go back and talk about humanity's story, because I love the story part, if you guys will indulge me with that. Right. Humanity actually had just figured out what the jump drive did. There was a big accident where they were doing some solar analysis and things like that and figured out, whoops, oh, here's an FTL drive. So they were just sending off their first colony ship when the Hivers show up at the exact same time. And they blow the ship out of the sky and proceed to do orbital bombardment. They don't respond. They don't say, hi, we're the Hivers or anything like that. They just start attacking our world. And only by the skin of our teeth are we able to – is humanity able to basically rewire all of our nuclear arsenals to shoot them back up into orbit and drive off the Hivers. So 10, 13 years later, that's when sort of the Stars starts. Well, a little bit past that, actually. And we are out to kill the Hivers. Because they almost killed us. So humanity has unified under Solforce, one government that runs all of the colonies, and have militarized humanity, and they're out there to kind of, you know, we're not going to, we almost got exterminated. It's never going to happen again.
So it's Shades of Ender's game.
Yeah, exactly. The Lear are telepathic, telekinetic, cetaceans, dolphins. They live underwater, but they are air breathers, and they don't have very much of industry. But what happened about 100 years before Sword of the Stars 1 began, the Sulka showed up, and they actually forced the Lear into a into the space age, so, and enslaved the Lear. So the Lear eventually fought back and rebelled against the Sulka. They created what they called, what they told everybody was a biological weapon, and actually threw off the Sulka. So now they're out in the stars to say, you know, we're never going to be enslaved again. We're not going to be the victims anymore. We're going to be, even though they're telepathic, so whenever they hurt anybody or kill anybody, they feel it in their minds. So it's their actual military is segmented from the rest of their society because they have to become psychopathic killers to actually be in the military, and they never get reintegrated again. There's, like I said, I mean, there's tons and tons of material out there that you can read about those guys. But all of their ships contain that oxygenated liquid, like from the abyss, right? So all of the cetaceans are swimming through there. And if you look in Sword of the Stars 2 and you look at the Lear ships, there's a lot of open portals and you can see all the water that's the water that's inside their ships. The third core race is the Tarkas. They are a lizard-based race. They're kind of old empire people, kind of like the Centauri from B5, or like the old Roman Empire is kind of some shades of that. Former glories that they have, and they also, although they're lizard-like, they kind of have a guerrilla social structure. So there's one like silverback that kind of runs things on the ship or in the society, which is kind of interesting around them. And then the Hiver guys, they're the bug guys, but they're not a hive mind. There's one queen that runs the empire, and then there's a princess that's on each planet. And then they create a bunch of drones and workers and warriors and different castes like that. So there's some of the tropes that you see, you know, in sci-fi, but there's also twists twists to the tropes that occur. Then the first... go ahead.
That's what I was about to ask you about, was in the expansions. Mm-hmm. Like, who was the first one? Because those are the junk guys, right?
Right.
I don't remember what they actually are supposed to look like, but whenever I saw their ships, I thought, well, these are like space Skaven.
They're called the Zool. They're a marsupial race. They were genetically engineered by the Sulka to kill the second expansion race, the Morigi. So they were designed to be bioweapons. The males of the Zool are very psychically attuned, and they build a coterie of females. The females look like giant kind of bear weasel things, and they reproduce like crazy. So they invade by basically dumping a bunch of females on the planet, and they reproduce like crazy and overrun the planet. They're designed as biological weapons. And then the males psychically dominate a group of females, and it kind of becomes his herd, his pack, his things like that. But when the Sulka got driven off by the Leer, it left the Zool to themselves. So they lost their god. They lost their creator. The Zool don't have a very long lifespan. They only live for about 30 years. But with their psychic abilities, the males started dominating other races and learning about other things and learning how to create FTL drives and spaceships and things like that. So they've been living on the fringes for the last 50, 100 years, building their own society from scratch in order to find their gods, to go back and find the Sulka, which is kind of fun. Then the other race is the Morigi. Those are the big dragon feathered kind of guys. They're the basis for a lot of Aztec legends, a lot of dragon legends and things like that. They are a trade race. They're actually get along well with a lot of people. They have some psychic powers as well. So it was Born of Blood, which was the first expansion, kind of brought in slavery and different kinds of warfare to it, some economy stuff, and then the second expansion brought in trade. So it was kind of an advancement of gameplay mechanics as well as the game itself through the expansions. So then the big shift... Go ahead.
No, it's just there were three expansions, and from what I remember, they added a ton of new stuff to the game with each one.
Yeah, new mechanics, definitely new mechanics, not just, right. Here's another race, yeah. Here's another skin. And again, everybody's got a different FTL drive. So the Tarkas actually have the most basic one. They've got a warp drive, so it works a lot like Star Trek, right? So they just need to go superluminal, and that's what they do. They can go anywhere at a particular speed. They're not the fastest race, but they do use up the most supply and resources, so they're the least fuel efficient. The Leer actually do micro teleportation, so their ships are so heavy because they're filled not with gas but with liquid. They've developed an inertialess drive called the Flicker Warp, where they actually teleport. They teleport like millimeters at a time, but millions of times a second. So the further they are away from a gravity well, the faster they can teleport, and that's how they move with their inertialess drive. The Zool have a drive that's similar to the humans, but they drill their own node lines. So there's a special type of ship called a node bore that you actually use to draw your own node line, and then once you do that, then the rest of the fleet can go down that line much faster, but you have to keep maintaining. They keep on collapsing and things like that. And then the Morigi have a gravity drive, a bow wave drive, it's called the flock drive. The more ships you have in the fleet, the faster it goes.
So I'm going to ask you a direct game related question. When I first tried to play this, I tried to do it, I think, with the tutorials. I don't think there were any tutorials, so I just tried to jump in. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yep.
Then I read the manual. had something of an idea of what I was doing, but had no idea which race to pick. Yep. So, as a new player who wants to play this, which race would you suggest as a good starting race?
The Tarkas. The Tarkas are the easiest to understand. They are the default race in my mind. Their technology capabilities are pretty much average across the board. They're not focused on particularly energy weapons versus kinetic weapons or shields or things like that. They're not a high-tech race like the Lyr are or the Merigi, but they're kind of an average run-of-the-mill race, and then their FTL drive is very easy to understand. Something like the Hiver or the Zool are very tough. So the Hiver, actually, they slowboat everywhere, but once they get there, they build a gate. And then once the gate is built, then they have instantaneous travel between anything connected to... so they're very good defensively, but you know they're coming because you're going to see them on sensors 10 turns before they show up. You just have to fight through their fleet enough to get to the gate and destroy the gate, because if they can set up the gate, it takes a turn to set up the gate. If they can set up the gate, then their entire empire, depending on the capacity of their gate network, can come through that gate the next turn, and you've pretty much lost.
So yeah, the Tarka. Okay.
Yeah, if you're starting a game, start out with the Tarkas. Don't force yourself to run a bunch of guys. I mean, the initial map in Sword of the Stars 2 called Altus or something like that. It's a 5-player map. It's relatively, it's not super 3D. Relatively easy to understand. Just run a Tarkas, randomize the other guys, and just start with that.
Okay.
That's always been a problem that I've had with the game is the map, because maybe they've done a lot to make it better in the second game, but in the first game it was kind of like the color of the stars was that not set at like actual star color or something, but it wouldn't show, like, I wanted all my stars to just be my color.
Yeah, it was kind of a Skittleverse thing. Yeah, that's what we called Sword of the Stars 1. In Sword of the Stars 2, you've got the stars are colored pretty close to what nature intended. So you've got a lot of red and orange and a couple white and blue stars out there.
But can I turn an overlay on so I can just see my territory?
Right. So there's always you will be able to see at any zoom level, you'll be able to see your own, which stars have colonies of your own on it. Yeah.
Okay.
And there's overlays that you can show about which star systems you've scouted, you've surveyed, and which ones you haven't. You can show political boundaries, things like that. So there's better stuff there, but that is one of the knocks against Sword of the Stars. I don't think it's particularly warranted, but that they use a 3D map. So there is verticality. There isn't a string of stars that you've got that you have to defend. It's like a wall or a sphere that you have to defend. So it can be a little tough. And
yeah, that was tough for me first going in, because a lot of space strategy games don't do that. It's usually a flat plane, easy to manage. It's like, this is here, this is there. And I jumped in this and I was like, what's... Yep. It looks closer, but it's actually further. Oh, God. I don't know where anything is.
You can get around it by spinning the map a little bit, just kind of getting that idea. But the disc maps and the spiral maps are relatively flat, so you can start with those to get used to that. But it's really interesting because it's not, there's multiple fronts, right? You're not just butted up against two empires, right? Because you've got this wedge of the pie and everybody else has this other wedge. It could be, somebody's coming in from the top or the bottom. Yeah, there's some interesting strategic differences by having actual 3D space. And there is one map in the game called the Sotsverse, which is actually the closest 100 main stage stars next to our solar system in their accurate positions, and I believe size and color too.
I haven't tried that map. I think the one or two games I tried were with random maps, and I think I first played as the humans, because humans, they want to be human.
Yep. Nope. They're
they
not
should the- be the default. You know, they should be the first race you play in games like this. Why not? They're humans. They should be the easiest to understand. And I was like, what is happening? I'm so confused.
Yeah.
Having the manual helped, but one thing that bugged me about it, and I've run into this a little bit more so lately than I would like, is there was no tutorial. There's still, I don't think there still is. Are they do you know if they're planning on adding one? Because that is like a hugely glaring omission.
As far as I know, there isn't plans for one. Oh. And, but I don't know for sure. I've actually tried to do some, you know, some video tutorials and stuff like that. I did some at the end of last year. Yeah, but real life kind of got in the way, and I didn't complete that. It's difficult. There's the in-game references that they have. The manual, as you mentioned, is out there. They even wrote a beginner's guide as well. But it's a difficult game, because they didn't necessarily build the game based on the tropes of interface or things like that you've seen before, right? So it's not what you expected. It's the anti-endless space, right? I mean, it's not an easy interface to.
So it's tons of fun. It has lots of soul. It's the anti-endless space.
Sorry. I think so. That's my opinion. I think it's got lots of soul to it. I think it's got lots of character to it. That's the thing that keeps bringing me back is, you know, it feels like there's a real empire and there's a real flavor to the empire and the faction and the faction that I'm running when I play the game. So,
But you're not actually controlling really any production stuff, right? It's just you own this planet, and because you own that planet, it generates X dollars per turn, and you spend them.
Right.
So there's no ground game that's going on there, and there's no like build facilities or whatever. It's just completely fleet management. Right?
Yeah. So any kind of micromanagement is just happens at the fleet level. The idea that you know, you take for example Earth, right? The billion some odd people that are on this planet. If I build a factory on that planet, what does that actually mean? It doesn't mean much of anything. So they abstract that out by saying that you're basically the infrastructure that you build on the planet when you're building your colony. It's the population and the infrastructure, and infrastructure is a percentage. So your planets are rated from 0 to 100%. And if a planet has full population based on the planet size and is at 100% infrastructure, then it is outputting as much as it possibly can in terms of money and resources to be able to build ships and make money and all that kind of stuff. So,
okay,
from that side, it's a lot more simplified.
I think I think that was another level of confusion for me because I was looking for that.
Yeah.
You know, I did not know that was not there. Like in Distant Worlds, I know that you don't really play with that. You don't have to because there's a civilian level and they do most of that. But I was kind of looking for that in Sword of the Stars 2, and when I didn't find it, I was like, what's happening?
So Sword of the Stars 2, the way that you customize your planets is through stations, right? So if you want a planet to be a spot for – if you want it to be a place for fleets to repair and return to after goes on missions, then you build a naval station there. If you want to increase your research capabilities, you build a science station there. If you want to make it part of a trade network, you set up a civilian station. If you want to increase your capability to interact with other factions through diplomacy, then you build diplomatic stations, things like that. So that's the way that you actually can customize your planets and systems in the game, but you're not building, you know, this place has a factory and this place has a theater and this place makes four hammers and this place makes, you know, three points. So that's not part of the game. So
it's basically all about the space game then. It's not, there's really not a lot to do with the ground game, it sounds like.
There isn't. I mean, it's really, so another one of the big differences between Sword of the Stars 1 and 2 is it's all fleet-based, not ship-based. Right. So So you combine fleets and you have them under a flagship command, a special command type ship, and then you send those fleets out on missions, right? So they have a base of operations, and they have a certain amount of endurance and supply that they can do to actually go out into space, accomplish their mission, and return back before all their supplies run out. And they work together as a fleet. You don't send out individual ships one at a time to different locations unless they're command ships in and of themselves. But command ships don't really aren't really good at fighting. They're not ships of the line.
So it's not like you build 10 scouts, send them out to 10 different systems, and discover the whole map as fast as you can like you used to, right?
Right, exactly. And since systems are complex, so in Sword of the Stars 1, systems were basically the star and a planet. So when you zoomed in from the strategic level down to the tactical level, you were always in orbit around the colony, the one colony that was around that star. Everything else was inferred or off the table. In this one, you actually have complex star systems. You've got different numbers of planets on around a star. You've got asteroid belts that are around the star. You've got moons off of gas giants that you can colonize on, things like that. So when you zoom in to the tactical level and you're doing your fleet management, you can actually break up your fleet and try flanking maneuvers and swinging around a planet, you know, hide these guys in the asteroid field so when they come by, we'll ambush them. You know, those sorts of things play out during the real time fleet management piece. But going back to the survey thing, right? So your fleets actually have to go from planet to planet and figure out what's going on out there. So the more ships you have in a fleet, the better off you are in terms of doing that survey.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that whole fleet thing sounds radically departed from the original gameplay.
Yeah,
because it used to just be like, well, you know, there's a fleet here,
or many games in general, a lot of games don't do it that way.
Well, and it's not only the fleet system; it's the mission system too, right? So it's not a case of you. Now they've changed the UI and the updates that they've done, so you can actually do it the other way around. You can select a fleet and you right click on the fleet and you pick a mission and you pick the target for it. So if you've got a survey fleet that's at base, you can actually right click on the base, click survey, and then it'll bring up a list of nearby star systems that you can go survey. But a lot of ways that you do it is the other way around. So it isn't a case of I'm going to move my pieces from here to there. It's more of an idea of this is what I want to accomplish. I want to colonize this world. So I write,
and then it says who's available.
Exactly. And then it brings up a list of who's available and how close they are and all of that kind of stuff, and which ones are qualified, you know, to actually do that mission. The most recent race, the Loa, which came out with this extended edition, End of Flesh is what it's called. They're actually an AI race, and they're made out of Super Lego. So they don't. They actually travel through FTL. They create these ring gates that they scatter between the stars. It's a little bit like Cowboy Bebop. You know, they keep on going, but light years apart. And they only travel in indifferentiated monoliths of Lego. And when they actually wind up in the system, then the Super Lego reconfigures itself either into a survey fleet or a colonization fleet or a war fleet or stuff like that. And then they reconfigure themselves back up and take off for the next world. So it fits in with that mission system along that way because you know, you might send fleets out to survey, but then they get into a fight, so they got to retreat. Then you send out your strike fleets, but they only have a certain amount of time on target because they don't have enough supply ships. It's really kind of trying to make that whole World War II kind of vibe to it.
Well, and it sounds like if it's AI that are named after voodoo things, it gives me the whole William Gibson cyberspace thing from Neuromancer.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that.
It kind of harkens to that.
Yeah.
So, but that's kind of a neat concept. So, but they're just an additional race that they've bumped into. They're not like the big bad guys, though.
No. So here's the secret that you learn between Sword of the Stars 1 and 2. the Sulca are actually the Leer. So not only are the dolphins psychic and telekinetic, but they're also immortal. So they just keep growing, and they keep gaining more and more power. And eventually, after a couple hundred or thousand years, they become too big to actually support their own body structure, and they wind up dying through crushing their own weight. But every 10,000 years or so, a Leer grows so powerful and psychotic that he actually psychically dominates the rest of the planet, forces them to build space armor for himself, and then he teleports himself out into space, and becomes this huge Cthulhoid, multi-tentacled, kilometers-long space whale that's psychically powerful beyond all belief, called the Sulca. So the Leer are actually
Spoiler, dude.
No, this is known. So once they actually figure that out, the Zul meets up with Alir and says, "Holy crap, you're our gods." And they actually split into two. And the Orthodox Zul allied themselves with the Sulca, and the Prester Zul actually rebelled and joined the Leer to fight against. Because what happened, their biological weapon that the Leer used to drive off the Zul was actually creating a Sulca of their own. It's called the Black, right? He's the guy who runs space, right? So with the Leer, there's one super dolphin, the biggest, baddest dolphin, basically runs the planet through the meta concert of their psychic emanations and stuff like that. So the guy who runs the fleet, who runs the military, he basically spent the last 50 years hunting down the Sulca and killing them one by one. And only the seven most powerful actually were able to survive the attacks or run away. And now with the younger races kind of messing around with their old technology, those derelicts that were actually pieces of battle suits that got blown off in the fight, and the Zul rising up as this huge horde that's kind of waving itself across the galaxy, because they breed like crazy and they go out and psychically rape and steal information out of people's skulls all the time. So they're this huge force in the galaxy, and they start calling out to the Sulca and bringing them home. So there's seven of these big Cthulhoid tentacled gods. And if you actually play the Zul and you don't build diplomatic stations with the Zul, because you're based on the Mongol horde, right? It's tribute stations. It's like, hey, give us enough stuff and maybe we won't destroy your entire civilization, is how they operate. If they get to the final level of the tribute station, which is an altar, they can actually summon one of the Sulcas to join their fleet and fight on the battlefield.
Oh wow.
Jeez.
So that's like their giant robot secret weapon.
Exactly.
They summon the Death Star.
That is the Death Star, and there's different aspects. So each of the seven aspects, so there's one guy who's huge and gluttonous and he always eats everything. There's one guy who's stealthy. There's one guy who goes into the biotechnical stuff, and he's the guy who actually designed the Zul, and they've honored him by building a city on his back. And then there's another guy, there's the Siren, who's the best psychic coercion being in the galaxy as far as we know, and she actually stole a bunch of the Marigi away and made them go insane and fight each other. So everybody, all seven factions in the game, because they're not races anymore, because in Sword of the Stars 2, the Zul and the Leer actually join up together. So you might have Leer battleships, but they pull into battle with them non-FTL capable Zul ships that are got a whole bunch of guns on them and stuff like that. So each of the factions has one of their own Sulca that's kind of allied or aligned directly against them, which is kind of too. Huh.
So do the Zul, whenever they summon one, do they get to choose which one they get, nope. Or that's random?
It's random. Yeah. One of the seven random ones will show up and actually become part of your. They give you a big boost in terms of research at a cost to population, because when they try to inject information into the minds of the tiny Zool, they tend to explode. So, so they, you get research boost, and then they've got these huge battle tentacles that can basically, you know, destroy ships with a single sweep, and all these psychic powers and all that kind of stuff, which really messes with the Loa, because they're not psychic. They're anti-psychic. They're silicoid. They're not carbon-based, so psychic doesn't work against them. So they kind of show up and sort of maybe save the day, although they're not really excited to be back on stage, because they were basically the slaves of all the other races that rebelled and ran off themselves and created their own society. But now that the Sulka are back, they've kind of been dragged back to meet their makers, so to speak.
Yeah. So does each race have... Because the tech tree is randomized, right? Like a little bit.
There's a core that everybody gets. So like FTL drives the capability to build the three classes of ships: the cruisers to the dreadnoughts to the leviathans. Right? There's always going to be a core of technology that's there, but the rest of the tech is randomized. There's a handful of technologies that are only particular factions specific, but then particular factions have a predilection to get, like the Leer are good at biology and high tech and lasers, versus the Hivers, who are good at armor and ballistics, for example.
Okay. Is there a particular like strategy to each race as far as the research goes? Like, if I'm playing, let's say, the Terrans, do I want to just race up the weapon track, or do I want to go for a balance between the different technologies, or is there, like, something that it's like, I'm this race, I have to race to get to this technology quick, and then that enables me to play better?
So that's actually one of the big things, replayability, for sort of the Stars 1 and 2, is that there is no... You got to get this tech. You got to go up this. You got to go up this line. There is a chance, although you've got, you know, although certain races have a higher probability of getting a tech than others, there's still a chance that you might not get it. You might not get point defense lasers in your game. That's just what happened. Yeah. So you can try for interceptor missiles, or you can try for shields. But
the thing is, though, whenever you look at the tech tree, you're going to be able to see, even though you haven't invented anything yet, you get to see the whole way to the end of the tech tree for whatever was generated, right?
You get to see the next level. Yeah, you get to see.
Oh, but you can't see like two steps ahead. Nope. So it's still a little bit of a box of chocolates. I don't know what I'm getting here if I go up this tree.
Yeah. Now there's references out there that, you know, blow out the whole tree and show you the probabilities. I think there's one on my wiki as well. But yeah, I mean, you can go, and there's multiple paths to it, right? So if you're doing energy cannons and you start out with plasma cannons and you try to get fusion cannons, and it says, whoops, you know, you can't get fusion cannons, but you research this other technology, then that might open up a different path to go get fusion cannons. Or you can also, if you've got a repair and salvage cruiser in your fleet and you defeat a fleet, there's a chance that you can salvage the technology off of your opponents if it's there on the field, and then you can retrofit it to your own ships at that point. So you're never, but that's the replayability thing. It's like, I always go for these five techs, and these are my game winners. Yeah, it might not work out this game. You might not get to four out of those five of those techs. So you gotta figure out a different way to accomplish what you want to accomplish. But the other thing is that when you actually get down into the tactical battles, everything is simmed. So every bolt and bullet, it's not a roll to hit. It's the turret has a certain speed that it rotates. It takes aim on the directions or the AI that's built into the ship, and it takes aim and it fires, and that bullet travels from one end to the other, and if it hits anything in the middle, that thing takes damage. So there's things like friendly fire, there's stuff that you know, that if you've got a fast ship, you want to shoot lasers at it because those are more hit scan type weapons versus the ballistics, or if they're a small ship versus a large ship. So there's a lot of complexity built into the combat engine that kind of evens a lot of that stuff out. So even if you're not, you know, like I said, so if you don't get point defense lasers, well, you can try for point defense chain guns, which aren't as good at hitting smaller missiles, but they're good at hitting the bigger planetary missiles that come up and try to destroy you, or torpedoes for that matter, or you get shields, or you get interceptor missiles or stuff like that, right? So there's multiple paths to accomplish what you want to accomplish. You just have to be flexible enough to be willing to go down those paths, and don't stick yourself in, this is how I play every single game. There's too much randomization built into it to do that.
So what's the history in this game? Because they released it, and it had some major problems. And did they? What caused that? And also, what have they done as far as like the goodwill of the community, and to get people that heard like that initial, man, this game came out and it was half baked and it's totally busted and we're all angry, and now they've apparently put this expansion out that also is like a messiah patch that brings the game to what it always should have been.
Yep.
And everything's perfect now, or what?
So you even go back to Sword of the Stars 1, and when Sword of the Stars first came out like 7-8 years ago, it wasn't the perfect game when it came out, right? But what they did is they kept on updating things, right? So free patching, free updates. Yes, they came out with expansions, but there wasn't any – the stuff in between, right, was their capability to do those tweaks and balances and fix bugs. I can't speak to the release of Sword of the Stars 2, mainly because I don't know what happened. That's something between the developers and the publishers and the business that's behind that. That's part of the sausage making that I don't want to know about, and I don't.
But what was the state of the game when it came out? Because all I heard was, "Oh my god!"
In my personal opinion, it was unplayable. You could not complete a game. And honestly, I set it aside. I really wasn't, you know, I saw what was there. I saw the potential. I saw what they had in the design and all of the cool things like complex star systems and this faction model and the fleet models and the mission models and things like that. And I thought it was very cool, actually, a simplification in their trading model too. But it wasn't there. It wasn't necessarily hooked in or working. But what they did is every week they came out with a patch. So it's a Steam game. It's pretty much a Steam-only game, and they have used that capability of Steam to do your own patching on your own schedule as opposed to going through the publisher and requiring, you know, QA and all that kind of stuff. So for the first year plus, they would release a patch every week to fix things and add things and turn things on. And then after that year passed, they were also, so, you know, the engineering guys worked on fixing and break fix and all that stuff, but the artist folks still kept on working on their stuff. So they built the new faction models and things like that. So when the stars aligned and they got the game to what I would consider release capabilities, right, they also had the expansion ready to go. So the decision of the publishers and the developers was that, you know, we're going to basically have kind of a relaunch with the expansion. So thank you for the people who have stuck it out with us, but here is this new content in this game for free. I mean, you can't go on Steam and buy the game without buying the expansion built into it. I mean, that's why it's the extended edition. So,
which I got to say that I hope fostered a lot of goodwill, because that doesn't happen very often in gaming in general.
Well, I'm just wondering how much press they're actually getting in the wake of it, because, you know, if it weren't for talking to Brian about it, I don't think that I would be aware. It would still be this game that's like, well, I'm not sure what state it's in, but I remember that it was apparently unplayable when it came out. So I'm not real clear where it's at today. So how do they get that message out other than one person at a time, word of mouth?
Yeah, it's through the community. I mean, they kind of had a relaunch, but honestly, you know, that's a little bit of what's going on with Kerberos is doing now, right? So that's where you get into sort of the Stars of the Pit. They're going full indie, right? So sort of the Stars 2 is published by Paradox, which is an awesome strategy publisher. Right, I mean, these guys make maybe not necessarily space strategy games, but you know, Europa Universalis, they did Magicka, you know, all those sorts of games. So,
no, they make fantastic stuff. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Crusader Kings 2, I've just started scratching the surface of it. Holy crap!
Yeah,
That's amazing stuff.
Yeah, doesn't it line up well, right? Because it's a deep, you know, there's a lot of UI, it's very sim based, it's not very gamey based and all that kind of stuff. So, that's the publisher of Sword of the Stars 2, and they are the people who funded basically the expansion and the relaunch and stuff like that. But the question about where they go from here, what Kerberos has publicly said is that we want to be able to be independent. We want to be able to do the things that we want to be able to do on our own schedule, so to speak. So they've always been smart, and they've always owned their IP. So they've actually gone through – this is their second publisher. They had a different publisher back with Sword of the Stars 1 that kind of flamed out and died. But they've always owned their own IP. So in their trying to go full indie – they came out with this roguelike, Sword of the Stars, The Pit, which takes place in the Sword of the Stars universe, but has absolutely almost nothing to do with spaceships whatsoever. It's a roguelike where you're going from room to room. You're either a marine or an engineer or a scout, fighting against monsters and trying to go down levels to get to the source of this plague that's going to save your world, kind of stuff, right? So the big Sulka, the guy who created the Zool, he dropped a plague on your world, but he's also got a research base there. So if you can make it to the bottom of the research base, then you can find the cure for the plague that's affecting your world. That is self-published, right? They actually started it with an Indiegogo campaign that got them some of the seed money that they needed to go out with. But that's been a lot of their focus right now, has been doing updates and keeping content coming out for that game. The contents and updates have continued past the extended edition for Sword of the Stars 2, but they've definitely tapered off because it's not a big team, and they've been focusing on this roguelike.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Steam update page for Sword of the Stars 2, and there's like 50, 60 updates on here since October of 2011. That's something to sneeze at, I got to say. I never actually looked at this, but that is pretty impressive. So it looks like they have another spacey game coming out, according to – I'm looking at the Kerberos website right now. Have you heard of this thing called North Star?
So North Star was something that they were talking about back with Sword of the Stars 1, and they've teased a couple things about it in terms of making it kind of Firefly-like, right? So it's not the one man in a facility thing of the pit, but it's like you have a crew and a ship, and you're trying to make your way around the universe. So kind of I wouldn't say Star Citizen-y, but you know, a little more tactical and personal than the Empire spanning stuff. And my understanding is it's in a separate universe as well. So it's
okay.
But as far as I know, there isn't. I don't think they've announced anything. I don't know if anybody's. I'm sure they've got tons of story and lore about where they want to go and what they want to do with it, but I haven't heard anything about that lately. So
Story of the Stars, The Pit, that's a little roguelike. I have not played it, but it's been getting some good press.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the ways that you can look at it, and one of the ways that I personally look at it, and I'm sure the Kerberos guys are going to listen to this, and they may have some words for me, but I think it's amazing when you look at Sword of the Stars 2 and you realize that roughly 10 or 12 people made that game. At the level.
Oh, wait, that's it? That's it?
Yeah.
Oh. That's impressive.
This is, yeah. So their capability to put that much content and information and to be honest, polish around a game like that is nothing but monumental. But did they overreach? Right. So because they didn't want Sword of the Stars 2 to be Sword of the Stars 1 with DirectX 10. Right. So they added new technology. They added, you know, they added new, they changed it. I mean, they changed it from a World War I model to a World War II model. And did they extend themselves a little too far? And, you know, I think you could say that the launch kind of bore that out. With Sword of the Stars, the Pit, I think they hit the nail on the head, you know, in terms of what they could accomplish, what they needed to accomplish, and the time that they needed to accomplish it. I think everything lined up, and I think that's why people are giving such a positive response to it, because it's allowing that team to kind of show, hey, you know, we really do know what we're doing. We can make a good game, you know, on time and under budget, blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. You know, here, let me show you. And it's not the scope and scale of Sword of the Stars 2, which, you know, loses a certain amount of appeal myself because I like the big strategy games myself. But in terms of, you know, hey, it's a roguelike, there aren't really many roguelike space-based games out there. This is more roguelike. I know people call FTL roguelike, but that's mainly because of the permadeath idea and randomness, restart. You could be effed up, but you just go again and do it, right? That's about the extent of roguelikeness that FTL has. This is the actual, you know, you can draw a straight line from the ASCII rogue games of yore to this game. It's top down. You move from room to room. You've got an inventory. You've got food that you need to keep up, your health, you know, all that kind of stuff. So,
okay. I'll be honest, I didn't know really much about Kerberos before I started talking to you or even doing this website thingy. So I'll be honest, I was wary about this whole the Pit thing. Yep. Part of me was like, okay, Sword of the Stars 2 isn't really done and they're asking for money for this. But when I hear your story, it makes a lot more sense as to why they did this.
Yeah, they're trying to be independent. They're trying to be able to be self-published. You know, they saw, just like everybody else, you know, the Kickstarters and the, you know, the things, the Double Fine and the stuff that Chris Roberts, you know, was talking about, and the capability for these niche players to create things that they want to create without having to go through the publishing system as it exists today. So.
And God bless them. Let me tell you, God bless that kind of stuff, because we have been seeing a lovely little resurgence in space gaming.
Exactly. Because the audience,
in no small part.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's that when the publishers are all about going big or going home, right? If it's, if it doesn't make Call of Duty numbers, then it's not worth putting money into. But exactly. That doesn't mean that everybody who loved Wing Commander back in the day wouldn't love to play Wing Commander again, right? And I think Chris Roberts and Star Citizen absolutely showed everybody how that could do. Nobody would want to touch adventure games. Well, go talk to Tim Schafer and Double Fine. You know, they were able to find enough people to do that. So is it going to, you know, is Sword of the Stars, the Pit, going to sell 10 million? No, it's not, but they don't need it to. They're making games for the audience that they're making them for.
They're not subjected to the whole like Metacritic 85%. You know, if you get 84% at Metacritic, your whole studio gets laid off, and it just seems like more and more you can't innovate because your project is expected to drag the behemoth of EA or Activision or whatever along for one more quarter. But
the main piece around that, though, and you guys are showing me examples of that, is how do you, since everybody's got an indie game and everybody's out there doing the stuff, how do you find the ones, if they're not attached to a big name, to a name that has nostalgia value or that kind of cachet to it, how do you become known that hey, we've even got a game out there, guys, let alone this is what it's about and this is what it does.
Well, I think it's hand in hand with getting some traction in the bigger websites. But I think that media journalism, I'm air quoting that, but the game journalism is in the same boat as EA and Activision and that. And we've seen a lot of collapse of game journalism this year. I mean, like 1UP is dead. I forget what all sites went down in that fireball.
GameSpy. GameSpy is gone.
Yeah, GameSpy, Yu-Gi-Oh. Yeah, it's just like that whole the giant corporate side of both. Because they have become an interdependent, interwoven beast. I think they both suffer together in that. So, where do you do your PR? You know, where does your promotion engage? And I think it's going to have to be back to a grassroots thing, much like what we're seeing with Kickstarter. You're going to have to also engage with your community is smaller. And you're going for the niche audience, therefore you have to go where they are. So if you're doing a flight sim, you better get over to SimHQ. You know, if you're doing a space game, well, here we are. So
that's right. You're one stop shopping for that. And you know, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, but the guy who's doing Falcon 4 in space, right? So from my history, you know,
Rogue System.
Yeah. The Rogue System guy, right? So you look at – it's not a competition, but you look at the Rogue System guy versus Star Citizen, right? So it's there's an apples and oranges thing kind of going there. But I'd love to play Falcon 4 in space. I'm more of a free space guy than a Wing Commander guy myself. But, you know, that's – there should be room for both of them.
At one time there would have been plenty of room for both of them, for all three of them, for many, many more of them, but that time might be coming back, but I don't know.
I think if I were a Bond villain, what I would do is I would go get Larry Holland and I would lock him up in my volcano lair until he made the sequel to TIE Fighter, and then everything would be okay.
Well, you think about it too, and there is the capability to make, you know, my hope when I hear about things like Rogue System and Star Citizen and stuff like that, I look back at XCOM. Right, so maybe not a spaceship game, but a spacey, a sci-fi game. You know, they took something that was beloved and actually modernized it and did a pretty darn good job at it. So,
yeah, I thought that they delivered excellently. Yeah. By the way, did you see there's an iOS version of that coming out shortly? And it looks mint. It looks like the PC game, and that's all I could ask.
You know, one of the Kickstarters that I know, Brian, has everybody sent you all their money so you could get an iPad, Brian? Or are you still?
No, I wish. Still without? That'd be lovely. Right, I'm still without.
Send all your dollars to. No, you know, one of the Kickstarters I went in big on was Planetary Annihilation, guys. Right, so it's Yeah, we're going to bring back, you know, the Supreme Commander, the Total Annihilation guys, and they've got to hopefully modernized it and twist and all that kind of stuff. But I put down big money for that to get into the alpha and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's probably my third most expensive Kickstarter behind Star Citizen and Limit Theory, where it was
okay, that so one. question about that. Gas-powered games, was it? Yeah, it's gas-powered. Mm-hmm. That made those, right?
Yeah.
They kind of flamed out this year too, didn't they?
They're back.
They got bought. Yeah, they got bought by Wargamer.net, I believe they're called, who do World of Tanks.
Oh, okay.
And they actually came out, I like Supreme Commander 2 quite a bit, and they came out with a big patch for it 2 weeks ago.
Oh, neat. Yep.
Another game I own and yet still have not played.
I am surprised that they actually like once these things get to the point where they're selling for $5 on Steam, I'm wondering what the business case is to justify putting development time into that title still.
I think it's goodwill. Honestly, I think you cannot. There is no price you can put on goodwill. And
oh yeah, well, like if you're working on the next thing, you want people to know, like, hey man, 5 years down the road, they're still kicking this can for us.
I think it's the community, right? So if we're talking about the collapse of journalism, and you're only going to be, you know, in the press if you've got, you know, the right PR people or the publisher backing you, then it is that word of mouth, and the word of mouth is the community, and the community is going to be based on, you know, either the forums that you have, the website that you have, or the community around the last game that you have.
Exactly. And if you build a solid reputation based on, you know, support, goodwill, making great games.
Yeah. So is there anything else out there that you've got your eye on?
You know, I really do. I liked Endless Space. I love the UI of it, but I kind of agree with you guys in terms of, you know, once you scratch the surface and, you know, get into the depths of the game, there's not a lot different there from what I've done before with a lot of 4X games. Yeah. I'm excited. Go ahead.
See, I actually like the game for that reason, though, because it's like, if I want Master of Orion, I'm going to play Master of Orion. But if I want something that, like, it was on sale for like $10 last week, so I bought a copy for my wife, and it's just the thing of like, okay, we can sit down. She actually played a lot of Sword of the Stars 1 with us. There was a group of like six of us, and we'd get online and have like all weekend long games of that. So she played that, but it was things about it, like the 3D-ness of the map and situational awareness in general, really kind of irked her with it. And I'm looking at this game and I'm like, well, this is perfect because it's scaled down to a very simple, you know, she's an iPad gamer primarily anymore. And it's scaled down to that clean interface, and you look at things and you can totally understand what they do. And there's not like, you don't need a college course in the game to actually complete a game of it successfully. So I think that's neat. Jury's still out on the combat system because like something like Sword of the Stars, you go in there and you can see like all the little turrets turning and that's great. This thing is more like I put X number of beams and X number of missiles on this ship, and we're going to play rock, paper, scissors, and I get to modify with some cards. Which is okay, especially if you're playing multiplayer. If I'm playing a game and it's me and Brian are fighting, and you're just an observer, do you really want to sit there for 15 minutes and watch us duke it out, micromanaging little ships? Or do you just want it to be like rock, paper, scissors, okay, I won?
Yep. So one of the interesting things about Sword of the Stars that I didn't mention is that it is built from the ground up to be multiplayer, drop in, drop out, all that kind of stuff. And absolutely. And the way that they
the AI picks up your
the AI your will fleet. Pick up seamlessly if you exit the game, or you can join a game that's in progress as long as they're, you know, putting it out there for hosting and take over for an AI. The way that
That would be kind of disorienting in the extreme if you dropped out and then a turn went by and then you come back, because then it's like, where's all my stuff?
Yeah, there's
the AI could have a totally different agenda and just turn all your ships around. And
that's definitely, maybe not in one turn, but if you leave for 20 turns or something like that, it could definitely affect that. But the way that they handle that in terms of the tactical battles is that A, you can observe other tactical battles. I think you need to unlock some technologies to do that, but you can observe other tactical battles that happen within your sensor sphere, so at least you're not sitting there completely twiddling your thumbs. And then B, it's limited. You actually set that when you set up the game, and the default is it's 5 minutes a round. So there will only be 5 minutes worth of battle before the next turn occurs. So,
oh, cool.
Okay, guys, here's an interesting thought then. Why don't the three of us set up a game at some point in the future? We could talk after the podcast.
Sure.
And I don't know if we're recorded on video or what, but we'll try out a game, and I'll write about it for the site.
Yeah, I'm totally down with that.
I think that could be
okay. It'll have to either be Endless Space.
No, I'm talking about
which is
this.
Not what
no,
you mean.
I'm talking about
I know.
This.
I know, but I'm trying to think of a way to force you to play Endless Space. that's right. I'm going to drag you through the broken glass. But
get drunk. Yeah, then
So what we need, I think, really is a tutorial on Sword of the Stars 2. Like if we can play a game where we just all hold hands and make it through a few turns, and discuss like the strategy of like, well, I've got this, what should I do with it?
So there's so in the game, right? So if you don't have a support structure, you don't know Paul Tobia directly to call him up and say, hey, what's the problem? There's actually a global chat function that links into an IRC channel. So that's actually used. Yeah. It was added after it's a recent addition, but if you click on the global chat in the game, you're connected to an IRC channel with everybody else who's playing Sword of the Stars 2 or connecting to the IRC server at that time, and you can get a lot of questions answered in real time there.
Not only is that super awesome, but I completely understand why it wasn't there when the game first was. Because... it would have been used for a completely different purpose.
Oh my god! Totally.
The commiseration lounge.
But yeah, I'm totally up for some multiplayer, guys, and we can record it and stuff like that. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be Sword of the Stars 2. We can play some. We can play some different games too. So
no, it has to be Sword of the Stars 2. Because right. You've convinced me to reinstall it, and I'm actually reinstalling it right now.
Well, there you
then
go.
My job is done. So,
yeah, you've actually convinced me to give it
another
shot.
The pusher is complete. So.
Nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, well done. I mean, because, you know, the website doesn't have a lot of info, and the manual, it's not bad, but it's not great. So, you know, being able to talk to you, you know, directly about this stuff is like, it just opens your eyes, man. It's like, oh, okay, maybe this is.
Well, this is the thing. They need better PR.
They do.
That's the whole root of that. Yeah. That is, they just need to have somebody get the damn word out, because it could be the best game ever, and nobody knows.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of. Again, you know, if you're not AAA, if you're you know, one of the guys in the middle, you know, like a lot of these, where a lot of the interesting things are happening around space games and gaming in general. I think that is the big issue. Is, you know, I love the introversion guys. You know, they're kind of the original indie guys with Darwinia and Multiwinia. How many people know about Prison Architect that they're working on right now, and you know that it's in alpha, and how you actually play it, because there's no information on how to play it out there and things like
personally,
that.
Personally, I find a game based on Prison Architect, like Prison Tycoon, I find that absolutely creepy as shit.
Yep.
because it's like it honestly, it shouldn't be a game. But like the thing that I think would be awesome is if it was sold as like, oh, it's this fun little casual strategy game, but then it actually makes you think about, wait a minute, that I'm looking at these reports that are like profitability per inmate, and oh yeah, we need to get more kids in here on minor offenses,
so
because we have to keep the books green.
So they actually their tutorial walkthrough thing that they've built into the alpha is actually taking an existing prison and building the infrastructure to execute one of the prisoners in your population.
Come on.
No.
What?
Yep,
that's not real. They
point straight at it, man. They're going for it. So,
yeah, but see, unless that is framed correctly, it's kind of like, woohoo, build the gas chamber. Yeah, prison needs more Vespine gas. So
what's the sequel, a concentration camp sim? I mean,
well it's the thing, if they put like corruption in there, right? There's a corruption model, like, well, you have to bribe the judges to convict more people so that we can keep the numbers up in the prison population, because this is a business.
See, I think that's that's metagame going beyond what those guys are going for, but that's what I love, right? I mean, this is, you know, that they're actually out there doing games like this, you know, that will never be approved by a publisher anywhere, let alone get on, you know, get past Apple or something like that, you know, to wind up on their store. But
Postal.
Yeah. Well, no, because Postal sucked, right? I mean, it was just shock value.
But I'm just saying,
it wasn't, you know, it didn't have any merit to it or a game to it, really.
But it's funny. Yeah. I heard on another podcast, they're like, is this the year of the indie? It's not just this year. Hello. Have you been around? Have you been looking at things?
It's been the year of the indie since Richard Garriott was putting it in a Ziploc bag back in 1986.
But not even that. Like, the last couple of years have just been amazing for this stuff.
Well, it has been a crazy great last 5 years for gaming.
I think we're
people realize.
No, I think we're in a second golden age. We're spoiled as hell. You're absolutely right.
I think it's the realization that you can sell 200,000 or 20,000 or however many thousand copies and make a game and get a community, get a population, and run a business, right? You don't have to do Call of Duty numbers, right? Even Call of Duty isn't doing Call of Duty numbers. You don't have to build World of Warcraft. You can still run a business. You're not all going to run around, you know, in Ferraris and diamond encrusted, you know, whatevers, but you can, if this is your passion and this is what you want to do, you can make a business out of it, either from a strategy game or a space game standpoint or stuff like that. If you do it smart, you find your audience and you make a business out of it. You know, I think that's the explosion, is that there isn't just, because of the distribution channels, there isn't just one path to getting your game out to people, which is beautiful.
Yeah, and I think it kind of really took off with the App Store on iOS. And I'm not a big fan of Apple, and I'm not a big fan of the closed walled garden they have, but god damn if that didn't start a lot of it, that didn't really jumpstart a ton of indie development.
But the big, well, not only that, but you've got the price war that happened very early on, and prices immediately rocketed into the basement. Like, what's the cheapest thing on the platform? 99 cents. All right, boom. That's the number. All games cost 99 cents. And then it took a few big publishers like Square Enix and that to say, no, we got the balls. We're going to put out a $15 game.
But how well are they doing? I mean, is that actually viable? Can you put out a $20 strategy game on iOS and actually?
I don't
make
know,
that
but
work?
they keep putting out games on iOS, as far as I know. So something must be working.
I think the good gauge for that is a game like The Bulge. Or is it Battle of the Bulge or whatever? But it's about that World War II battle. Yep. It's an iOS war game. And it was $11, I think. And I bought it gleefully. I was just like, wow, cool. Finally, somebody made
a real war game.
Somebody made like a for real war game here. That's great. So I don't flinch at $10 if I really like the game. Avedon, the Black Fortress, came out at that price point. So I think that there's definitely tiers. There's 99 cents for like, I don't know you, I don't know what this game's about, and it's like an endless distance running game or tower defense. God, I'm so sick of it. Please stop making tower defense games. But there's that. But it's like, if you've got a track record and the last game was hella fun and it's really great, I'll give you $5. Yeah. That's right. Not a problem, because I look at the other side of the coin. If you're into portable gaming, my wife has a 3DS. You can't touch a game under $40. They're all $39. Yeah. And it's just like, well, I think they're going to price. Well, they're the only game in town, unfortunately, with that. You know, if you want to play a Mario game or something, that's where you're at. I think the price point is definitely the entire economics model of indie games got reworked because of the App Store.
Yeah, I agree.
Definitely.
I agree. But
and then you see the Steam sales. Steam is also a big hitter in that, because it's like, what am I going to buy this game for full price?
Four times a year,
this bad boy is going to drop down to $10, you know, instead of 30. I'm going to wait, just like I did with Endless Space.
The beauty of it, though, is that there will be people who still buy it at the full price when it comes out, because there are people who have to have it now.
Right. But then you have the long tail.
Yeah.
And the long tail, is, you know, you can keep reducing the price on it, and they keep – I would like to know – at Steam, what kind of psychologists they have employed whenever they do the Steam sales, because they do freaking like cruel mental torture on those Steam sales, because it's like, do I buy it? I don't know. Okay, I bought it at $5, and the next day, damn, it's $1. You know? So, yeah, it's a game in and of itself. I swear that they are having some kind of research into shoppers that goes on there, because they're using those Steam sales to make a rat maze that we all run, and then they figure out what their pricing is going to be for the rest of the year.
And they're willing to I got to give lots of props to Steam because they're willing to change their business model too, right? So everybody took a look at Minecraft about how they released the game for money, but they didn't really release the game, right? And they made a ton of money. So now they've got the early access stuff. So you can get games like, oh, I don't know, maybe Kerbal Space Program now through Steam.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, I'm
very happy
to
see that
too, man. Oh, you got to get back into that, Brian. Yeah,
I know. It's so intimidating.
I want to see more flailing around and and horrible. They've actually their latest update. They've included not effects. They've included graphical effects, but when you do re-entry now, you actually get graphical effects. Your ship doesn't technically burn up, but instead of just going down very fast, it starts heating up and little streamers come off of it. So,
oh no!
Yep.
I want to see that.
Yep. So I think you need
to go crash
some more rockets there, Brian. I want to see that.
I want Kerbals to actually be a villain in some other space game. It's like the Kerbals succeeded and then they started their empire and now we must go shoot them all. And I think the best one would be in that what's that game? It's Gastric something where you're flying cupcake.
Galactos.
Yeah, Galactos. Yeah, see, they could be the enemies in Galactos. It's cupcakes versus Kerbals.
They're flying the turkey mothership.
Yes.
You can hit your Kickstarter at this address.
Yeah, I'm wondering, there was some talk with Kickstarter, and I kind of brought it up with Chris Roberts, and of course he's up to his eyeballs in Kickstarter, so he's got a tainted opinion. But I'm wondering though about the way that people treat Kickstarters. It's like, well, I'm entitled to such and such because I pre-purchased this thing on Kickstarter. And it's like, no, you kickstarted it, you didn't pre-purchase it.
Yeah.
Right? But they're kind of blurring the line there because they're making guarantees. But the guy that's making Rogue System said, oh, no, there's financial penalties if you make promises on there and you fail to deliver.
They've required you to add to your proposal, right, the particular risks that you're having and things like that. I think that's why the early access.
That's a requirement now, the risks and everything? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's a requirement of Kickstarter. But that's why I like the Kerbal Minecraft Prison Architect model, right? So it's let me show you the game as it exists. Give me money to finish it, right?
Yeah, that's what the Rogue System...
Allow me to continue, right.
Yeah, yeah, he's going to do that now. He's going to set up a web shop on his website.
When you guys talked to Chris, it's like, yeah, Kickstarter started everything, but they made a lot more money off of their direct sales than the Kickstarter sale, right?
They actually started on their Robert Space Industries. They start crowdfunding there first, and there were a lot of people who, because there's a safety net to Kickstarter because they don't charge you. If it doesn't succeed, which is one reason I like it. But a lot of people wanted that option. So they started that maybe a third of the way, halfway through the entire thing. And they made $2 million something on Kickstarter, but they made $6 million through their own site.
And they can continue to make it, right? Because Kickstarter is a campaign, right? A start and a finish. You could go today, you could go get Planetary Annihilation and get access to the beta and all that stuff off of their site directly, too.
Yes. Yeah, with Star System, you can still kick to it, I believe. I think they just passed 8 million, 8 something million. So, yeah, I think they're still taking money.
But he did
on the site.
He did the bulk of the funding. What I was surprised, see, there was confusion going into that interview because I was like, well, you got 6 million somehow, and then you've got the other 2.5 million off
Kickstarter. And I was coughing too much to correct you.
So it's like, well, where did this 6 million come from? And I thought my initial thought of that is kind of a fear that I have in gaming. Is like, okay, well, I need to go to venture capital guys, but the venture capital guys are going to say, go to Kickstarter and show us that you can drum up $1 million, and then we'll give you the other six. right? So at what point does a Kickstarter become a prerequisite to getting traditional funding?
Right, so it's a it becomes a gauge of interest as opposed to an actual, this is how I want to get my game made.
Right, or not only that, but it's a thing of like, well, burn through that initial million first, and let's see, before we've invested money, let's see if you actually can make a game and deliver milestones and things.
I think Star Citizen does have some VC funding besides...
They've got some, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was part of the plan. I think, you know, it's show the interest, show these VC people that, hey... There's enough interest to raise money, and you know they'll put in some more. So, I think with Star Citizen that was an element. I know there have been other ones I've heard of where VC was definitely an element as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the $6 million that he claims that the $6 million portion of that is actually they opened their own web store.
Yeah.
So it's like crowdfunding through their private portal was $6 million, and then through Kickstarter was the other two.
Yeah, that's how I funded it. I did it through their website, and mm-hmm. they got more than $100 of my money. And I hope my girlfriend is not listening to this because she won't be happy about that. The sad thing is, if I had more, I would have given more. You know, because Jesus.
That's nothing diamonds can't fix.
So, Paul, the other big strategy game I think you mentioned is Distant Worlds. You've been playing some of that?
Yeah. I love Distant Worlds.
Is that not the best?
The thing that I love about it, so I really get into the simulation aspect of things, right? So the idea that the galaxy operates without you and the way that you played it, I haven't played it that far down to be, you know, just a spaceship, you know, one spaceship and work my way up. But the idea that you've got all that civilian traffic going on that you'll never, ever touch, but it still affects what you're doing and the things that you need to do. Actually, going in that direction, Drox Operative. Right, there's a whole world going on around you.
Yeah, that's another great one.
Right, you're a single ship within a 4X game that's going on. Right, so and you'll never zoom out to that level. That's the thing that really gets to me with Distant Worlds. You know, in terms of the graphics and the combat models and the and you know colonization models and stuff like that, it's pretty simple and all those things. You know, there's ship customization that's kind of fun in there, but I haven't really even dug into that too much. But but just kind of, you know, it's almost a screensaver for me. You know, I let it kind of run in the background, and then if you know, you get that little alert goes off, and it's like, "Ooh, cool! What happened here? You know, which way is that fleet going?" and stuff like that. Yeah, Distant Worlds is a lot of fun.
Oh my God.
Is there any provision for that in Sword of the Stars 2, where you can actually like let the AI run some things? Or are you the commander and everything?
You're pretty much the commander and everything. There is a civilian aspect to it, so you can put part of your budget towards what's called stimulus, either for trade or colonization.
But it's not like you can hire an AI to manage.
Nope. There's no major domos like Distant Worlds does. Yeah.
Okay. So, have you messed around with Star Drive any?
No, I haven't touched that one yet.
Because it on the surface, I thought, well, this is like Distant Worlds, right? Because you have direct control of the ship, and you actually fly it around in a star control kind of way, right? But it's I don't know. I've messed around with it a little bit, and it's just it hasn't clicked with me yet.
It's not clicking with a lot of people, and I need to try it, honestly. But I'm wary. I need to just dive in. But yeah, that's a tough. I think that one's going to be a tough sell because I think it looks like, based on what I played, it has a great idea, but it might be trying too hard.
I wish that I could loan games out on Steam. Like, seriously, it's like, I can't play it if you're playing it, but I'll let you, you know, it's the same as like, I could give you my username and password, right? And then I can't play any of my games, but it's a thing of like, I just want to put this one game on loan to this other person, because how much would sales go up? Because it's like, I want to play this with you, but let me give you a taste of it.
I would love to be able to do that with Distant Worlds, because Jesus. If people could freaking try that game, they might actually freaking buy it.
Yeah, I've become, and we had that conversation about silos earlier in another podcast, was like, I'm a Steam guy, and if it comes up on Desera or whatever other Gamers Gate, the other handful of services out there, or the evil Origin, I'm very anti-Origin because I don't need anything else residing on my system sniffing all my files constantly. You know, it's like my PC doesn't need performance hits from your always-on DRM, so I won't buy anything that's on Origin. And, you know, so Steam is my client of choice. So if it doesn't come there, it's kind of tough luck.
Yeah.
So, but I feel for, I mean, Steam is getting more open because they're allowing a lot of more indie things. They had Greenlight. I think their thing with this early access,
it's kind of their response.
Maybe them saying, maybe them saying Greenlight's not as fluid as we wanted it to be.
Yeah, it's definitely their response to Greenlight. It's kind of failing Greenlight. It's not great, like, at all, really.
Well, it takes too long.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, do you get greenlit or not? Okay, fine. It's
and then eventually there was just a bunch of shit, just absolute shit. Like, there are people putting games they just wanted to see up there, not games they're making. Like, someone put Wizardry 8 on there because they just wanted on Steam. They're not making Wizardry 8. They had nothing to do with Wizardry 8.
Yeah,
just wanted to see it on Steam. So then they like had a fee you had to get on there, and people didn't like that.
Yeah,
it's just been a mess.
Yeah. It could be good for indie games, maybe, but I wonder what the path is. We should engage with some indie place and just say, what was your path from, like, I'm writing this game, like Retro City Rampage, right? Mm-hmm. How the hell did they get on Steam? Like, somebody that works at Valve saw it and was like, we ought to reach out to this guy.
As far as I know, there's an approval process you have to go through. Like, the guy who made Drox Operative that we just mentioned, Steven Peeler. At first, his games were being flat out denied access to Steam. Like, he would submit them and they would just, I don't think they'd even tell him why they said no. They just said no. And now he's starting to get a little traction on there because they see, oh, the Geese games sell. Let's put them up there, but they haven't put Drox Operative on there yet. It took them years just to get, I think, Depths of Peril, which is his first game.
Yeah.
It took him years just to get that on Steam. So, yeah, there's some kind of odd, obtuse approval thing going on that we should see if we can get a person from Steam on this damn thing to talk about this.
This is the flip side of, you know, what we talked about earlier. So how do you get people interested in your game, and how do you break into the distribution channels that are out there, even though they're more diplomatic or more demographic or you know, wider spread now, right? These are the challenges of the people who are making games nowadays, not necessarily which publisher am I going to go to, how much do I have to sell my soul, you know, to get mm-hmm. this operating capital for the next year and a half. It's more like, how do I deal with Steam or Gamers Gate or Origin? How do I get a community? How do I, you know, engage my people and all that kind of stuff? That kind of stuff is pretty fun. You look at what Chris Hecker's doing, you know, Gratuitous Space Battles, guy, you know,
and
he's open about that stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I got to say, Desora, you mentioned that earlier, Jim, is insanely indie friendly. I mean, if there was like an indie Steam, that's it. And there's.
Yeah, but I feel like. See, this is a thing, though, with like the Apple Store, all right? They have a vetting process that software has to go through, mm-hmm. and it has to meet certain criteria, and it has to be of a certain quality generally, right. to make it through, right? So you have to get through their filters.
Sure.
Desera, I don't know, is that filter there? On Steam, it sure as heck is. So I trust if it got to Steam, it's going to work.
I've never had a problem with a game on Desera. I own maybe 30, 40 games through Desera, and I've never had one problem.
It's the curation question, right? So How do you, who do you trust? Do you trust the distributor? Do you trust, and that's why they're trying to socialize. You know, you take a look at Steam and how much they're pushing your capability to recommend games and stuff like that. So you can do that, maybe not loan a game to somebody, but at least you tell everybody, hey, this is really cool, you should buy it. And while they're captured within, you know, within that structure. So it's not just trusting the distribution channel, but trusting the people that you trust on that distribution channel to go pick out the right games. Because this is the flip side of it, is that instead of having, you know, one Call of Duty every year that's or Madden or whatever, you know, we've got all of these interesting games out there, and how do we find them? How do we find the time to play them, and how do we find the good ones?
Yeah, well, I'm doing everything I can with the site and this podcast. Thank you, Jim. So
you're doing yeoman's work. I'm trying. What you're doing out there quite a bit, and
I'm trying.
I get sad when real life intrudes on you, Brian, and you go dark for a couple days. So
yeah, I'm not happy about it either. Sorry, everyone, but it's the thing. It's work. Like, usually work is at a level where I have enough mental energy when I get home to actually do stuff for the site. But for the last, like, 4 weeks, it's just been, when I get home, it's just been like, screw everything. I don't want to even touch something.
Yeah,
Play Skyrim.
That's why my walkthrough videos aren't done, that's for sure. Yep.
Anyway, speaking of, we should probably wrap this up because I'm falling asleep right now.
I'm glad you're excited.
Not because y'all are boring or anything, but just I'm so damn tired. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I haven't been updating the site as much lately, is because I'm so damn tired. I don't want to do a half-assed job because, God damn it, y'all are worth all of my resources. God damn it. And if I can't give you a full 100%, I'm not giving you nothing.
but honestly, Brian, I think you're going in the right direction. I think the video stuff that you're putting out, the podcast, right? So that idea of the direction that things are going, as opposed to, you know, long form content on the site and stuff like that, I think you're striking a good balance with that. So keep it up,
thank
dude.
You. Well, thank you, Jim, for the idea, because he's the one who approached me about this. So this is Jim's baby, really.
Cool, and thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's always fun to talk about this stuff with people who know their shit. So, Paul, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a ton of fun. And we're going to have you on again at some point.
Absolutely, anytime.